The way we study Alzheimer's is changing. Today on Central Standard, we'll speak to one of the Midwest's leading researchers about new approaches to the disease.
Where we are now is we have the capacity in terms of our science to actually visualize these plaques in the brains of living people. And so we're moving into a new phase of our ability to diagnose and understand Alzheimer's.
I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's program, a look at efforts to study and support the research of Alzheimer's disease. Plus, a story of watching your mother change, brought to us from the Creativity Connection.
This must be so hard for you, I say, as I drive home.
It is.
Mom says.
But there's nothing to do but let it go and laugh it off. Otherwise, I go crazy.
That's ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. In the information age, short-term memory can sometimes be a chore. But with the onset of Alzheimer's, it's an obstacle, like climbing a rugged mountain. And this is for the diagnosed with Alzheimer's and their loved ones. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us to discuss new research into the brain disease and approaches in both medicine and public policy is Dr. Jeffrey Burns, Associate Director for KU's Alzheimer's Disease Center, and Michelle Needens, Director of Education on Programs and Public Policy for the Heart of America Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Burns, Michelle Needens, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Let's begin with Dr. Burns. Refresh us, if you will, on the clinical definitions of Alzheimer's and how it's evolved up until now.
Well, Alzheimer's disease is a brain disease that impacts areas responsible for memory and thinking, for doing the things that we take so for granted, you know, like organizing information and acting on information and seeking out goals. And so the disease is a neurodegenerative disease that impacts the brain and affects all these things that we take for granted that we do through the day.
It affects the basics, in other words.
It affects the basics, and obviously it affects memory the most and the earliest.
Michelle, how has public policy evolved in tackling this issue? We have the research component and the medicinal component, if you will, with Dr. Burns. Have you been following public policy and healthcare? This is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, going into the last days of it here in November.
Sure.
What have you seen?
Well, I think public policy matches what we know from the research front, i.e., we know a lot more about early stage than ever before, and that has an impact on public policy. One, we begin to see individuals with the disease begin to advocate for themselves. And when we didn't diagnose until middle stage and beyond, we didn't have the power of indigenous experience in that way. So it impacts that front. Certainly, we battle all the time with age discrimination and less interest in Alzheimer's disease. We see individuals who perhaps would say, you know, they're elderly anyway and not be so interested in perhaps affording some of the dollars to research or other care services that's needed. Alzheimer's is the one disease that will bankrupt the Medicare-Medicaid system. So we should all be concerned about it, and not just because of someone's age, but because of the fiscal aspects as well.
Follow through on that self-advocacy component. You mentioned indigenous anecdotal evidence. How is that evolving? You have people with the disease that are coming forward. Are they testifying before Congress and congressional committees, or
absolutely, absolutely. We have in the Kansas City area, we're lucky to have an early stage support group, and many of those folks translate to advocacy, and absolutely, they go talk to legislators both on the state level and on the federal level, and have had the opportunity to testify.
What are the biggest misconceptions that remain clinically? And I'll come back to you, Michelle, on public awareness. But clinically, what are some of the biggest misconceptions, Dr. Burns, that remain clinically right now?
Well, there's a couple that come to mind. The first would be I think we need to consider it a treatable disease. It's not a curable disease, and it's not something we can stop. But there are medications that have proven to be effective, and they are useful. And then the second is you might hear the phrase, it's not where are my car keys, it's what are they, as being diagnostic of Alzheimer's. And that's really not true. It's not we're making the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and recognizing it in the very early stages and recognizing it and making a confident and accurate diagnosis in the earliest stages. And so we shouldn't wait until it's what are my car keys. We should be seeking out help and looking for medical evaluations early in the process when there are changes that suggest memory is impacted and other cognitive skills like organization abilities.
And Michelle, how do you get those resources and awareness out to family members and people who are diagnosed themselves when they're still in the where are my car keys stages?
I would say it's tough. Partly because the society at large has not caught up with the knowledge about what early stage looks like. So I think many people who have concerns about memory are talked out of it early on. Oh, we all forget and do not proceed. So when we look at those individuals who are diagnosed, there's only a minority percentage that are actually newly diagnosed in early stage. So it's an ongoing endeavor on our part and everybody else's part to say to people, if you have a gut-level feeling something's wrong, have it checked out. Don't be talked out of it.
So Dr. Burns, denial is also a river in Missouri as well.
Yeah, denial is something we deal with, you know, on multiple levels with family, with patients, with their family, and then even with many physicians where, you know, it's this isn't a problem. Don't worry about it. You're 80. We choose not to give up on these people, and we see these changes as a problem, and they are a problem, and there are medications that can help.
Dr. Burns, this past August 2011, the KU Medical Center received national designation as an Alzheimer's disease center. What's special about that designation? How did that come about?
Well, that came about after about 7 years of hard work and putting together the center and then producing good research. So we've been working on that designation as an Alzheimer's center for the last 7 years. We brought in an investigator, Russ Swerdlow, who's the director of that center and has a basic science program looking at metabolism and the brain. And so it's basically the culmination of almost a decade of hard work. And we are now one of the 29 national Alzheimer's disease centers in the United States. It's a very, big achievement, and it puts Kansas City on the map for Alzheimer's research on a national level, but also an international level.
But the specific area of specialization that got you that 29th on the all-star team of Alzheimer's research, as it were, is metabolism. Tell us about that research.
So, yeah, it is metabolism, which is it's a hard concept, but scientifically it's how do the brain cells and how do our body cells handle energy, and how do they, we think about insulin and glucose and how the cells are using those substrates. And what we think is going on in Alzheimer's disease is there's a metabolic problem in the cells. And so it's that area of research. And this is something that I've been looking at on a clinical level. So we look at body composition. We look at insulin and glucose, diet and exercise. All these things influence metabolism. And Dr. Swerdlow looks at it on a cellular level. He looks at the mitochondria and the cellular processes that underlie these sort of bigger picture things. And so together we're looking, deeper and from a new angle into Alzheimer's disease. Most of the country and the world, and including us, we're looking at things like amyloid pathology. So in Alzheimer's disease...
Amyloid pathology. Back up and explain what that is.
So Alzheimer's disease is marked by changes in the brain that includes amyloid, a buildup of a protein called amyloid, and it forms plaques in the brain. And what we don't know, we've been looking at these plaques for 100 years. What's been assumed is they cause the disease, and they might cause the disease. But after 100 years, we're still not clear what causes the disease. And so the amyloid might be the cause of the disease. It may be the byproduct, however, of the disease too. And if it's the byproduct of the disease, we might be looking at the wrong things. Our focus is underlying metabolic problems that may be associated with this buildup of amyloid. So it's a different avenue of investigating the causes and potentially the treatments of Alzheimer's disease.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. The subject is Alzheimer's research. Our guests are Dr. Jeffrey Burns, Associate Director of KU's Alzheimer's Disease Center, which just won a grant, a special designation this past fall in 2011. Michelle Needens is also our guest, Director of Education Programs and Public Policy for the Heart of America chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. We're going to open up the phone lines now. Kansas City, has Alzheimer's touched you or your family? What area resources have proved helpful for you? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also hit us up on Facebook, and someone has already hit us up on Facebook. Monica on Facebook has advice for families dealing with Alzheimer's. She says, when the brain is altered, the personality is too. Unfortunately, the changes are usually hard to accept. The priority is to keep the loved one safe and comfortable. Michelle Needens, the changes are hard to accept. Can you expound on that?
Well, Alzheimer's in general provokes a set of losses. And that's true of the person with the disease. It is true for the family member. So it's not this entire disease. It's all the little pieces that go along with the destruction of the brain. So absolutely, it's tough to cope with. In addition, I don't think there's enough information about how do we manage some of the most complex issues that are common in the disease process. For example, some of the behavioral challenges and some of the affective dimensions. And as Dr. Burns said, you know, this can be seen as a treatable disease in the sense of we can manage some of the worst symptomology, and that's part of the struggle with coping.
Dr. Burns, brain chemistry is constantly changing with thoughts, environment, and patterns. How do we deal with these changes that are hard to accept?
Well, they're very hard to deal with. When it comes to personality changes and behavior problems, there are some approaches from a medical perspective in terms of medications that we can use to help the symptoms. But probably the best way to treat it is what we call behaviorally or trying to work with the patient and redirect them to move away from a problem or not pick a battle when we don't need to pick a battle and let them, you know, believe the false belief that they might be obsessing about at that point. So there are strategies, but, you know, there's no magic bullet for treating these kinds of problems.
Michelle, the Heart of America chapter provides support for families affected with Alzheimer's, as well as you mentioned the indigenous anecdotal evidence from Alzheimer's diagnoses themselves. What's the first thing you look at when someone comes to your organization for resources or help? What's the first thing you look at?
Well, often when people are coming to the association, they are presenting a set of challenges. So we look at all the tiny pieces that make up whatever that challenge is. There are individuals who call in who say, I'm experiencing these problems, and I wonder if potentially it's Alzheimer's. And for those individuals, what we would look at are differences. We would begin a conversation that looks at, what's the baseline, what's changed. Not necessarily if there's a problem, but looking at what the subtleties of the changes. Because there's many issues that impact memory that is not Alzheimer's. And so beginning to open someone's mind to there are other possibilities and that it's necessary to go in for a full dementia evaluation.
And speaking of evaluations and open minds, Dr. Burns, from clinical trials you've been involved in, how do you explain what's going on clinically? You got mitochondria, you got neurons, you got all of this esoteric to some people. It's your area of specialization. How do you explain this clinically and how it's working to families who are obviously dealing with confusion and grief?
Right. Well, you know, first of all, it's very important for families to recognize that these personality changes and this memory loss is a brain disease. This is not some action on their part to frustrate them. So it's important to see it as a brain disease. And the disease, you know, what we know about it is there is loss of brain cells in areas important for memory, and in particular for writing new memories, so short-term memory. So we see people have major problems remembering what happened, you know, this morning, yesterday, last week, although they very easily talk about what happened 20, 30, 40 years ago and may repetitively tell their war stories, but can't answer the simplest question about, you know, what happened yesterday. And that's because the area that's impacted in the brain earliest is the area that writes down short-term memories. Those long-term memories have already been written down. They're already formed, and the individual can recall them easily, but that information from yesterday was never recorded, and they can't call on it anymore.
Alzheimer's research is the subject. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Our guests are Dr. Jeffrey Burns and Michelle Needens. Dr. Burns is the Associate Director over at KU with the Alzheimer's Disease Center, and Michelle Needens is the Director of Education Programs and Public Policy for the Heart of America chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. We're going to go to Dana in Lee's Summit. Dana, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I had a question. My mother is 72, and she has for some time felt a gut feeling that something was wrong. She's talked to her primary care physician about it several times, and she's been told, you know, well, you know what the keys are, so you don't have Alzheimer's. You're just getting old. But her memory as short-term memory is not good at all, and she makes herself lists and writes things down a lot. But I also feel like just in the last year that her personality has changed, and she's a different person than she has been in the past. So since her primary care physician is not really helping out, what can we do? Can she go somewhere to get evaluated?
Michelle, you want to take this?
Yes, I would make an appointment with a neurologist. Is exactly what I would do.
Based on what she's saying, based on what Dana is saying, Dr. Burns, what is the best course of action?
Well, yeah, I think these are signs of something that needs to be evaluated. And I do think seeing a neurologist or a dementia specialist, which is generally a neurologist, sometimes a psychiatrist, to evaluate it and to look, you know, is it Alzheimer's or is it a number of other things that can cause problems in memory? But these are the kinds of signs, these subtle changes in personality. Often there's withdrawal, sort of a distance that wasn't there before. And there are short-term memory impairments early in the disease. And these are the things that should trigger suspicion and should trigger a medical evaluation.
Dr. Burns, while we still have Dana on the line, what do we know more today rather than yesteryear about what the causes of Alzheimer's are?
Well, so that's a great question. And you know, we know a lot about Alzheimer's, but we still can't say with confidence what's actually driving the disease. You know, we have hypotheses, and the number one hypothesis is that the amyloid plaques that we see in the brain of people with Alzheimer's disease is driving the disease. But there are other potential causes. We're at a point now where we're testing the amyloid hypothesis in people. We have new study medications that can actually interrupt the buildup of amyloid or remove it from the brain. And so in the next couple of years, the results of these studies will be coming out, and we'll be learning, does removing amyloid from the brain impact the disease? Does it slow the disease, or does it do nothing? And it's really probably the best test of this amyloid hypothesis that we've had to date. And so that we're really at a important time in Alzheimer's research where we're able to interfere with what we think might be the disease process itself. And so we'll learn a lot in the next couple of years.
Thank you, Dana, for your questions and concerns. Over on Twitter, KCMOKC talks about taking care of someone with Alzheimer's disease. Quote, patience and prayer got me through those long 5 years. Caregivers need care, too. That's from our Twitter account, KCUR@CST. Feel free to tweet during this live broadcast, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Is the phone number to call in and join the conversation. Prayer and patience. Caregivers need care, too. Michelle, how do you give caregivers care?
This is a family disease that affects everyone. The person with the disease is high risk for depression and stress and struggle, and it is mirrored in the caregiver and vice versa. So all parties need support and care, and that comes in the form of talking with people who have suffered similar losses, i.e. support groups, I think is essential for many people. Support groups are not folks sitting around commiserating on their misery. They are finding power in how to cope. And so I think support groups are important for folks. I think making sure that we don't trade off essential parts of who we are in the caregiving experience is important.
And what do you mean by not trading off essential parts of who we are?
Typically, caregivers will begin to give up many aspects of themselves and become more and more isolated in their care and devotion to the person with the disease. It is essential to being a good caregiver to say, yes, it's important for me to go to church. It's important for me to go to my bridge. It's important to me to go out with friends. That's not selfish. That's not taking time away from the person with the disease. That is adding some strength that will allow you to sustain in the long run.
Bradley on Facebook says, being a caregiver to a loved one with Alzheimer's can be very frustrating, lonely, and financially draining during that period in someone's life. But Bradley says on Facebook, you are not alone. We're going to go to Amelia in Overland Park. Amelia, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. So I had a couple questions, and I'll take my answers off the air. The first is dementia treatable by the current, like, early-stage Alzheimer's medication? Because I find that one of the scariest aspects of Alzheimer's. And then the second question is, can you expand on the early onset of Alzheimer's and diagnosis versus just regular memory things, like forgetting that where you put your keys or something like that, because I think that happens to everybody at any age. Okay.
Thank you, Amelia. I think these are two combined questions. Is dementia treatable, and what do we know about early onset? Is contracting the disease more random? Is it hereditary, or is it environmental?
It's probably both. There's clearly heredity involved. People with a family history of Alzheimer's are at higher risk for developing it. Now, that doesn't mean it's inevitable for them, but it does increase the risk. And environment likely plays a role as well. We do know from studies on looking at risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, things like a good diet and exercise in midlife reduces your risk in the long run. So environment likely plays a role on top of heredity. So in terms of recognizing the disease in the earliest stages, it's very important to look at changes. And Michelle discussed this earlier. But in our clinic, what we do is sit down with the family, and we hear about what's going on on a day-to-day basis, what kinds of problems have arisen, what's new, and how is the day-to-day affairs, how are they being handled, and are they being handled as well as they used to be handled? And if they're not, that implies there may be some biological issue in the brain that's driving this, and we need to look further. So we can recognize it early, and now are the drugs effective in the early stages? They do appear to be effective. Now, I do think it's important to think of Alzheimer's as a treatable disease. I don't want to overstate the impact of the treatment, however. There are medications that help. But again, they don't stop the disease, they don't cure it, but they do help, and they do help even in the early stages of the disease.
Michelle, what tools are we giving families to look at possible early detection?
What resources are you providing over at the Heartland of America Association?
The conversation has changed from just identifying problems to identifying changes. So that's part of it, is awareness and education around what does early stage look like. We also have programs at the association for those individuals newly diagnosed in the early stage to look at coping strategies and how we continue to remain in control, which is really important in the early stage. So education is part of that answer. Support is part of the answer, going to the place that you fear, which is what we just heard from the caller, is there's a lot of fear attached to this, and knowledge can mitigate some of those fears.
We're on with Dr. Jeffrey Burns, Associate Director for KU's Alzheimer's Disease Center, and Michelle Neatons, Director of Education Programs and Public Policy for the Heart of America Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Kansas City, has Alzheimer's touched you or your family? What advice do you have for other families in similar situations? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, a discussion about the traits of the disease, symptoms that even those without a diagnosis have for themselves. And we'll find out what the main differences are, plus a personal look at Alzheimer's from area storytellers. When we return. And welcome back to Central Standard. A World War II veteran might be able to tell you the color of the gun handle on a service pistol during the Battle of the Bulge, but he might not remember today's date. A grandmother may respond to the 23rd Psalms word for word, but she might mistake you for her brother rather than her grandson, such is the case with Alzheimer's disease. I'm Jabalani LaFall, host of Central Standard. Dr. Jeffrey Burns is our guest. He's the Associate Director of KU's Alzheimer's Disease Center, and we also have with us Michelle Neatons, Director of Education Programs and Public Policy for the Heart of America Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. They're here to tell us more about the disease and developments in medicine and public policy that shape the local and national conversation. Speaking of that conversation, Kansas City, has Alzheimer's touched your life? What's helped you and your family make sense of the effects of Alzheimer's? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Our Twitter handle is KCUR@CST, and you can also hit us up on Facebook as well. Dr. Burns, my maternal grandmother died of complications of the disease, and it occurred to me in retrospect that she must have had a lot on her mind in her 97 years on earth, raising 10, 11 children, a couple who died in the process, and having children move away, come back, having grandchildren. Does focusing the mind when you're younger help make the brain stronger?
Perhaps. The research is not definitive, but one of the things that appears to be a protective factor for Alzheimer's disease is having an active mind and having a high education level or an occupation that keeps the mind active. So these things are associated with a lower risk of Alzheimer's disease in the long run. Now your grandmother was in her 90s when she developed the disease. And one thing,
80s actually,
in the 80s. So one important demographic fact about Alzheimer's disease is when we reach the age of 85 and above, that age group has a very high prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. So about 50%, somewhere between 40 and 50% of people over the age of 85 have Alzheimer's disease. So her risk factor for developing the disease was clearly age. And not something like stress or being overworked through her lifetime, but age and longevity.
Natural degeneration, in other words.
Well, that's debated. Is this inevitable with age, or is it a biological problem associated with age? We know the prevalence is extremely high as we get older. Some people argue it's inevitable. If we live into the 90s and hundreds and beyond, it may be. But there are people who have lived in well into their hundreds, 105, 106, and not had any of the changes of Alzheimer's disease. So truly healthy brain aging is possible into the 90s and 100 and beyond.
Dr. Burns, you mentioned in the earlier part of the hour about the protein plaque buildup in areas of the brain that may block brain activity. Is this similar to the type of cholesterol-based plaques that block the aortas and ventricles of the heart and are prevalent in heart disease?
So that's a good question, and it's very different. We use the same term plaque, but the plaques we see in the blood vessels are very different than the plaques we see under the microscope in the brain. The plaques we see in the brain are a buildup of a small protein that appears to affect how the brain cells are working. Now, so they're very different.
It's a protein versus a fat.
Versus a fat, or an accumulation of fats.
We're going to go to Margaret in KC, who has some questions for us. Margaret.
Yes. I need to know what is the best way to share with a family member that you have concerns that they may have dementia or Alzheimer's so as not to have them resent, someone saying that they have it. Is there if they're not recognizing or if they're not saying anything about, oh, I feel different or something's going on and the other family member is seeing it, how do we bring it to that person without making them feel, intimidated by that statement?
Thank you for your question, Margaret. Social stigma, Michelle Needens, is very big with any brain disease or mental defect. How do you deal with that?
Part of the answer to that question has to do with individual personality, but we're going to assume that the person the caller is talking about perhaps is a strong-willed person who is threatened by the idea that perhaps their thinking is impaired in some way. What I would do is begin the conversation with explaining that this is about love. This is about love and possibility, to say, I'm worried. It may not be anything, or it may be something that's treatable, but you will help me. Most of us will help other people, and we will not help ourselves. So if we begin the conversation by, you can help us, your children, your grandchildren, to relieve these worries if we just have this conversation, then perhaps we decrease some of the threat. Part of the answer to that question also has to do with the stage of the person. In the early stages, logic, reasoning can work. And as the disease progresses, that kind of conversation may not work. So we may need to bring in the doctor or a third party to say, this is what I would recommend, and assist the family in that way.
Dr. Burns, and this is a question for Michelle Needens as well, if she would like to jump in. How do you delicately approach a diagnosis when family members have, up to the point of onset, been pretty independent, pretty self-sufficient? That, let's bring up that archetypical grandfather of the Battle of the Bulge.
Right, yeah.
Fighting the Nazis, comes home, raises a brilliant family, and he's been a rock all your life.
Right.
How do you deal with those sociological aspects?
Yeah, so it can be tricky. Because of the threatening nature of memory loss for people like that, and so one of the things that most people in the early stages will admit is there has been some slippage in their memory. There has been a little bit of change, and they're not quite as sharp as they were 5-10 years ago. And so, I try to get people to admit that, and then I try to approach it as, this is what we can do for you. We need to recognize there's some subtle changes in memory, and there are medications that can help you. Now, these are available. Let's use them. Let's give you everything we got to make sure that, you can live the life you want to live. It's tough, but I try to approach it with that idea of trying to avoid that threatening nature of the disease for them, and approach it as, let's create some opportunities here, and let's make sure we're not missing something medically, and let's make sure we've got every medication we can on board that's going to help you.
Michelle, some family members have at times even had to trick loved ones into treatment. Have you ever encountered such a thing or heard of such events? And how does the Alzheimer's Association deal with family nuances, cultural nuances?
I'm going to eliminate the word trick. And we'll put in creatively respond to challenges
right.
when perhaps the easiest pathway doesn't work.
Right.
And again, we're talking about middle stage when we have executive function so impaired that logic and reasoning isn't going to work. If someone in the early stage and logic and reasoning intact, whether we agree with their decision or not, there's some ethical limitations to what we would engage. In middle stage, when biologically we don't have the executive functions on our side, then we might creatively engage third-party individuals to say this is, you know, what's important. This is to help keep someone well, et cetera. And I do think there's some wellness interventions that go on with Alzheimer's disease. For example, I do think it's positive that people exercise through the disease. I do think it's positive to be socially engaged. So to have conversations about maintaining quality of life is a creative response and to say we can do this. Now, if you're talking about what we call therapeutic fibbing, that's also a legitimate tactic when we're talking about middle and late stage Alzheimer's disease.
Is that a clinical term? Is that a pop psychology term? Therapeutical fibbing. Hey, it's just therapeutic.
Whatever we need to call it.
We're going to go to Mac in Prairie Village. Mac, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, hey there, Dr. Bird. This is Mac Childs, and super proud of the work you guys are doing over there. But I'm a musician and music teacher here in the Prairie Village area and graduate of the conservatory. But Dr. Burns, I was just kind of wondering what the evidence was. You alluded to it a little bit earlier about whether the active mind and whether trained musicians or whether music therapy, the effects that it can have on either prevention or treatment of Alzheimer's.
All right, great. Thanks, Mac. Good to hear from you.
That's a great question from Mac. My grandmother, not to bring it back to her, but my grandmother responded to gospel spiritual. She responded to recited, repetitious things, such as music, such as chants, incantations, 23rd Psalms, for instance. How does that work? Mac has a good point.
Yeah, so, on a couple levels there, there's some important points. There is some evidence that, you know, music engages the brain in a way that, you know, as in exercise for the brain. And there's some evidence that musicians may be at lower risk for Alzheimer's disease in the long run. And it may be driven through the music itself and working the brain in a certain way, but it might also be that smarter people like Mac are musicians and are therefore at lower risk for Alzheimer's disease. So it's not clear. There is a lot of interest in music therapy, both as a prevention strategy and as a treatment strategy for people with memory problems. Another thing with respect to your grandmother is many people with dementia and Alzheimer's disease, especially in the later stages, might retain some musical abilities. They may still respond to music. They might be able to sing music. On the other hand, they may have major problems speaking. So you can see these odd disassociations where speech may be difficult, but singing a song may be very fluent for them.
And that brings up another interesting point that we haven't discussed, the quadrants of the brain, the left brain versus the right brain, the analytical versus the creative brain. What do we know from your research about how those things are processed? You just mentioned someone might know music lyrics and respond very well to that, but can't write their name. How does that work?
Well, the brain is highly specialized and highly there's areas that are, you know, responsible and interconnected with other areas for doing certain things like writing and for coming up with a word and for understanding words. And the disease generally is one that we see that sort of is distributed uniformly around the brain. But in some people, we see less uniformity and more impact in focal areas, so that speech may be the major problem, or perception, so visual problems might be the major problem as opposed to memory, just because the disease itself is hitting focal areas as opposed to being uniformly distributed through the brain.
An email to centralstandard@kcur.org from Julie in Brookside says, my mother, maternal grandmother, and aunt all had Alzheimer's. I'm now in my mid-60s. How and when should I get tested? Michelle?
Until symptoms are seen, there's not a point in getting tested. So if she has a sense that things are changing, that's when conversations should happen with physicians.
Speaking of which, we're running down to about a minute and a half here until we go to our special presentation from storytellers Ron Zoglin and Deborah Schaus. These traits of the disease, confusion, difficulty completing tasks, misplacing things, things that Julian Brookside talks about, this can happen to a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old. Some of these traits, to me, for instance, they happen all the time, forgetting keys and forgetting people's names that, you know, I saw every day. There's a different person sitting in front of me. So what's the difference, Dr. Burns?
Well, so the difference is traits. If somebody has a trait their whole life, you know, that's not something we're concerned about. We have to recognize we all have memory lapses, and we have them on a daily basis. We misplace our keys and our glasses. What's different in Alzheimer's disease is we have new problems. These aren't traits that have been present their entire life. These are new problems where, you know, they're forgetting conversations when 5 years ago they never would have forgotten that conversation. And so we get information from the family to help us in the diagnosis. And that's the kind of information that you can only really get from somebody who knows the patient very well.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. I'm Javelin LaFall. Our guests are Dr. Jeffrey Burns, Associate Director of KU's Alzheimer's Disease Center, and Michelle Neatons, Director of Education Programs for Public Policy at the Heart of America chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. It's Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reading lessons.
What does that say?
Dad asked from the back seat as we pass a billboard with a bright picture of a donut.
Dunk in and delight.
My mother reads, I've flown in to visit my parents in Memphis, and I'm driving them to their new favorite Chinese restaurant. Their old favorite restaurant is under new management, and according to my father, the crab rangoon, the wonton soup, and the fried rice have all suffered from the change. I pull into the parking lot, and my father asks Mom,
what did that billboard say?
Mom turns slightly in her seat to give Dad a sweet smile.
What billboard, dear?
Dad raises his eyebrows and looks at me as if to say,
this is what I've been telling you about.
Inside the restaurant, the proprietress greets Dad with a big grin and a warm handshake.
Mr. Barnett,
she says.
Mrs. Barnett, and this must be your daughter. We love having your parents eat with us. We wish they eat with us every night.
A girl of about 4 runs to the tables and clamps her arms around her mother's leg. The girl tilts her head to smile at my father.
Hello,
my father says.
Do you want a piece of bubble gum?
Her short black hair swings as she nods.
Yes.
Dad reaches into his pocket for a piece of gum. He takes Mom's arm and leads her to a table. I sit opposite them.
Who was that lovely child?
My mother asks when we are settled with menus and water.
That's Melly, the owner's daughter. You remember her. She brought you a fortune cookie when we were here last week. She read you a chapter out of her storybook.
Mom smiles, a conciliatory smile that is becoming her standard. That smile is her shield, her plea, her apologia for all she might have accidentally forgotten.
What do I like here?
Mom asks, looking at the large menu.
Wonton soup, sweet and sour chicken, pork fried rice.
Dad tells her, these are the same dishes Mom has been ordering since I was a child. As we eat our dinner, my father explains again their dilemma, the dilemma we have been discussing over the phone for several months.
Your mother just doesn't seem to be concentrating anymore. Like that billboard. She sees the billboard, she reads the words, and a minute later, she can't remember them. It's true.
Mom says, shaking her head ruefully.
I can't remember. There is nothing I can do about it, so I don't get too upset. Paul, I wish you wouldn't get so upset.
Taking a spoonful of soup, My father says,
I just want you to concentrate more.
My father is a third-born child of two Russian peasant immigrants. His father fought in the Boer War and worked on the Panama Canal. He thrived on overcoming adversity and challenges. My father is also used to adversity and challenge. He will conquer any villain to save the woman he loves.
Meanwhile, the woman he loves, the daughter of a Polish and Hungarian immigrant, stares at the two slim sticks resting beside her plate, chopsticks that for years she has enjoyed eating rice with, shakes her head, and picks up a fork.
That same weekend, I take Mom to the 75th birthday party of her dear friend Elaine. No men are invited, so I am going as her chauffeur and her spokeswoman. I always like it when my father hands me the car keys.
Hearing the keys jingle out of his pocket and into
my waiting palm reminds me of those long ago days when borrowing the car was a major coup.
Borrowing the car meant
I had our family's only mode of transportation in my sweating teenage hands. Now my hands are sweating because I have not been with my mom alone without Dad's watchful presence since her memory started slipping. As Mom and I drive through the neighborhoods, Mom asks,
how's work going?
Even though she has asked me this question many times already during my short visit, I answer again. I pretend this is a creativity exercise. My job is to answer the same question in a new and different way each time.
How are the kids?
She asks when I pause. I see how artfully she steers me into monologue, punctuated by her simple questions. As I park the car, Mom says,
where are we? Where are we going?
We're at Elaine's. It's her 75th birthday party.
Oh, yes, of course. Are you coming with me?
I'll be right beside you.
That's good.
Elaine's living room is brimming with women. I see Mom's face tighten as someone rushes over to greet her.
So good to see you, Fran.
Mom's old friend Poppy says, giving Mom a hug.
And you, Debbie, you look great.
Elaine comes up to greet us.
How are you, Fran?
Elaine says in a low, concerned voice.
I don't know.
Mom says, her voice so small and scared, I feel a well of sadness. I remember walking into the house when I was a girl and finding Mom lying unconscious on the living room floor. I remember the horrible, helpless fear that shook me, even while I tried to revive her, then called our neighbor in the ambulance. During the ambulance ride, Mom revived.
She'd had an attack of tachycardia, rapid heartbeat, and had fainted. And now, even though she's standing upright, looking beautiful in her turquoise dress and careful red lipstick,
I feel her helplessness, and I am afraid. I guide her to the food table, and we each select tiny sandwiches, curly carrots, saltine crackers with chopped liver, and sweet pink cakes. Then I take her into the den, and we sit together on the sofa near old friends from the days when Mom taught Sunday school.
Debbie, how are you? How are your kids? What are you doing?
Some of the women ask me. Beside me, I feel my mother relaxing as the conversation points to me.
So, Fran, what are you reading these days? Did you finish that Isaac Singer book that I told you about?
My mother's friend Gerda asks. Anxiety pinches Mom's face. Mom hasn't had much time to read, I tell Gerda. I wonder if Gerda doesn't know or just doesn't want to admit
that her friend of 40 years is changing.
I wonder if seeing those changes frightens her as much as they sometimes terrify me. The conversation swirls around us as more of Mom's friends gather. I sit beside my mother and field her questions.
Like she is a politician with something to hide.
As I talk, Mom starts to relax, smile, and laugh.
She is enjoying being around her friends without having to come up with answers. She is liberated from her forgetfulness and having fun, just listening, being here, and eating the sweet pink cakes.
When it's time to go, Mom and I each hug Elaine goodbye.
You take care of her,
Elaine says to me. Mom takes my hand as we walk to the car. I feel a sweet sadness at this surprising and vulnerable gesture.
Thank you,
Mom says. I imagine, or rather, I try to imagine, what Mom must be going through.
Wanting to connect, to talk to people, and having a mind as blank and frozen as a winter pond.
I imagine the anxiety that must come with each social encounter.
Are they going to ask a direct question? Are they going to refer to something that happened earlier? Do they expect certain questions back?
This must be so hard for you, I say, as I drive home.
It is,
Mom says.
But there's nothing to do but let it go and laugh it off. Otherwise, I go crazy.
Back home, my father is in his recliner, reading the newspaper. We tell him about the party, and I describe all the different people we saw. He looks pleased. My mother gets herself a cup of coffee and settles near him on the sofa with a book. I sit on the other end of the sofa with my book. We are all in our places.
The setting is familiar and comforting.
As long as I try not to notice that Mom is holding the book open and upside down on her lap.
Staring ahead as though all she can read is the future.
Alzheimer's is the subject day on today on Central Standard. That's from storytellers Ron Zoglin and Deborah Schaus. It's called Reading Lesson. You can find more about their work on their website, thecreativityconnection.com. We'll have another story from Ron and Deborah on our blog at centralstandard.org. Tune in tomorrow when we examine love at any age. You don't want to miss that. Our show today was produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our show's producer is Andrea Salenzi. Up to Date is next with the Ethics Professors. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.